Hello. Welcome back. This is me, Ian Montgomery, again, for another episode of the Challenger Cities podcast. But I'm going to assume you already knew that because you're back for more of this good urbanism, cities, innovation type stuff. Now, we're doing a couple of these episodes around Montreal, the city that I've made my home over the past few months. And I really, really want to dig into Montreal and what makes it special and what makes it frustrating with people who've been here a lot longer than I have. Now, Montreal really is one of those cities of contradictions. It's got a long legacy of being big, bold, and ambitious. It's also got plenty of examples of being a bit cautious and constrained. We've also got the whole language thing that will upset a few folks. But it is a city that has personality and character and soul, is at least that's my feeling of it. Anyway, few people have lived through Montreal's highs and lows quite like Andy Nolman, and I'm very fortunate to say he has become a very good friend of mine, and walking around Montreal with him is basically impossible to go a few blocks without somebody stopping him and saying hello. He's perhaps most famous as one of the co-founders that turned the Just for Last Festival into a global phenomenon. He's a marketer in the true sense of the world who believes like doing good, but with a little bit of bad guy swagger. And he's still one of the city's fiercest advocates, even when he can be very frustrated by what some things come. Yeah, we'll talk about some of the problems in this episode. We're going to talk about what Montreal's lost. Some of these things might still exist, but sometimes the essence of what they once were might fade a little bit. So we're going to talk about festivals. We're going to talk about fearlessness. We're going to talk about big, audacious visions. We're going to talk what's still there. We're going to talk about what it might take to get some of them back. We are going to cover a bit of the language politics thing. We are going to talk about the city's arteries being clogged with construction and congestion. And we're also going to talk a little bit about how what Andy's doing with his latest project, Hack, and how a pair of mismatched sneakers might teach us something about living together in a better, more productive, more creative manner. So I hope this episode is provocative. It sure as hell is passionate. And yeah, Andy's not going to pull any punches. So without further ado, this is a Challenger Cities podcast all about Montreal with the magnificent Andy Nolman. So on my list of people I want to talk to about cities, I've had your name on that list because, one, you're a big part of the reason I now live in Montreal, because you've been one of the best advocates for the city. And two, you've done loads and loads of interesting things that influence cities without being some sort of boring city policy. So, Andy, the best way to get these things started is the gist of, who the hell is this Andy Nolman guy and why should I care about listening to this for the next 40 minutes?
Oh my God, are you kidding? Are you kidding me? People are going to be so enlightened. People, their lives will change after hearing this podcast. Lives, I guarantee it, your life will change after hearing this podcast. The things I am about to say, the insights, the perspective, the getting deep into your soul and exposing things you never even knew possible that I will be able to bring forth all within the next 45 minutes. So let's begin.
So I want to begin with a thing of, you started off as, I dare you started somebody, off doing music journalism.
I dare somebody to turning off right now, but go ahead.
That noise you can hear is the people pressing stop and exactly. Skipping to the next episode on Spotify.
Going to Joe Rogan. Okay.
Fuck Joe Rogan.
You know, it's so funny. I remember Joe Rogan when he was like this, you know, he was a middling comic. Nice guy. It's so astonishing because you never know who's going to be what in life. Like, I remember, like, when I was in school, there were all these kids, like, oh, this kid's going to be a genius. He's going to be, you know, brilliant. And he ended up working, you know, as a porter on Via Rail. And that's a true story. It's a true story. So, you know, I remember Joe Rogan, like, nice guy, middling comedian, nothing phenomenal. Next thing you know, Trump looks to him for advice. It astonishes me. But anyway, life is strange.
The world's a weird place. The
world's indeed. So you were about to say something, but I interrupted. What a surprise. Go ahead, Ian.
No, I want to start. I don't know whether to start with your sort of weird career as like a sort of music reporter or whether to start with Just for Laughs.
Well,
or one feeds into the other.
Well, next year, believe it or not, it will be my 50th year anniversary of working full time. And I started at the age of 16 as a music journalist. The first thing I ever did was wrote an article about Peter Frampton coming to Montreal. That was at the peak of his popularity with Frampton Comes Alive. And That's how I got my start. So really, truthfully, that was all I ever wanted to do in life. I was the happiest guy in the world being a music journalist. I met everyone. It was a different era. I was backstage at every show. You know, it's funny. I just, for a completely different project, I ran into Bob Geldof. And it was last year. I'll be seeing him again this year in Munich. But I ran into him last year. We had a dinner together. And I'm saying, wow, this is so amazing. I remember like interviewing you when I was 18, you know, when the Boomtown Rats came out. And I still have the press releases and the press photos from that time. So I met, it was amazing when I think about the people I met as a 16 to 23-year-old kid, hanging backstage at shows and traveling. And what a life. I never wanted to do anything else. But I got fired. So there we go.
Wow. You're clearly too good at it, and you were deemed, you're destined to go into better things.
Well, I got fired because I threw wine at someone, but that's a whole other story.
We'll talk about that over a glass of wine. We'll try and not have you throw it over me.
Okay.
But I think the thing that you sort of became Andy Nillman famous for was like Just for Laughs. And it's probably relevant we're talking about this now because Just for Laughs is on again, albeit in a totally different guise in Montreal again. But it's one of the things that makes Montreal special.
Well, frankly, I think it's in exactly the same guise as it was. Somebody texted me today and said, oh my God, I have to pick up my pass at the Delta Hotel and then go see a show at the Saint-Denis Theater. Oh my God, it's like 1992 all over again. And it is. So I'm happy that the festival is back and that it's getting back on its feet. And I hope that it will continue to evolve into something that, you know, a festival, what it should be in this era versus what it was back in the 90s. But, you know, I'll take a 1990s festival versus no festival right now. But it is amazing, though, that no matter what I try and do, I cannot erase. You can say, why would you want to erase that from your past? And you're right. But it's amazing how that has stuck with me. And people still come to me to this day and think that I'm still running it and ask me what shows I should see and can I get them tickets? And guys, I haven't been there for years. It's amazing. But I guess there's a lot of worse things to have tattooed upon your DNA indelibly than you were responsible for bringing the world a whole bunch of laughter. So I guess I shouldn't complain. I'm not complaining.
No complaints there whatsoever, but like, yeah. I think it's such a, like, when I've hung out with you in Montreal, you will often talk about like this era of Montreal is this sort of place that I don't know because I wasn't here. And I still look at it from like the external perspective and go, this city's amazing. So like, what am I missing? What was I not here in time for that?
Okay.
In your mind makes Montreal this amazing city or made Montreal this amazing city?
Montreal has been amazing through many epochs, through many eras, through many decades. In the 40s, it was one of the places where Black musicians can play freely without the fear of segregation or the fear of racism. And it was an incredible city in that regard. So there was amazing talent that would come to the city and play. And people here really didn't care, Black, white, whatever. It was a beautifully united city back in the 40s and through the 50s. 60s, it was the time, like it was in the rest of North America, perhaps in the world, the hippies, Summer of Love-esque era. 70s were the 70s. That's when I kind of grew up here. And it was majestic because what was amazing about Montreal back then, what you do not see in the media right now, which you saw back then, was an integration of people listening to the same music and the same announcement. There was a radio station still around. I think it's a sad shadow of what it used to be, but then again, so was most radio. But Shom FM was more than a radio station at the time. To young people growing up in Montreal in the 70s, it was a gathering point for culture. And not you whether you spoke French or English didn't matter because the DJs spoke both and sometimes in the same sentence. It was astonishing. And you would be, I was a kid from a very, very Anglophone, English-speaking part of Montreal, yet I was fed a diet of not only some of the most progressive rock in England and the things that are happening in the United States and here at home, like local bands like April Wine and things to that effect, but we were fed a whole cacophony of French music, Harmonium, Beau Dommage, Les Seguins, I can go on and on, of the local French acts. As an Anglophone kid, I knew, Pour un instant, a song by Harmonium, as well as I did any of the Beatles songs. And that was amazing. And you went to shows together. And then what happened was, and this is the irony, and this sort of set the pace for this city for the rest of its life, right up until now, where the media, where the French-speaking radio station said, whoa, 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 hold on, these guys are speaking English and French. They're playing French and English music, and they're, you know, they're taking every French listener away from us. So the CRTC, in its brilliance, the Canadian Radio and Telecommunications Corporation, or whatever the C stands for, they said, okay, what we're going to do is English stations can only play X amount of French music and cannot speak French on air. So, and they gave it, suddenly there was that divide, and that divide led to, you know, I guess, governments exploiting it to the point where these days, if you say bonjour, hi, you can be fined. So what a wonderful world we live in.
I find the language thing fascinating, because obviously I'm still trying to figure out the whole French thing badly, but like, it feels like there's this world of the two were together and very, like, as you just said, very like mixed. And it actually worked quite well for unearthing things that previously wouldn't come together. And then by trying to make everybody happy, we end up getting to a point where nobody necessarily ends up being happy, because we try and plan it all from the top down versus just let shit happen.
Well, that's the story, top down. And if you can call government top, I really go ahead and wonder what drugs you're on. But no, you didn't necessarily call it top. I'm bringing it into the mix as calling it top. But that's what happened when government stuck its foot in, and it's gotten worse ever since. The people, if you walk the streets of Montreal, and Ian, you and I have walked the streets, and we went out to dinner a couple of weeks ago, and we went, did the jazz festival, there is no problem amongst the people. It's the government mm-hmm. that's making these ridiculous laws, and what they're doing in that regard are spawning on the radical lunatic fringe, and not the radical lunatic fringe that are saying, let's make this world a better place, the radical lunatic fringe that are assholes and are trying to be pains in the ass and going and reporting on a poor barber shop because of the English on his sign. This is a true story.
Yeah.
The English on his sign is the same size as the French on his sign. And that the name of his barber shop, although biblical, it's in English. So it astonishes me that what the government has done is brought out the petty little differences and these people who get their jollies by reporting things such as people say talking in English and an English sign. It's psychotic. It's not even Orwellian. It's just, you know, Orwellian on the draft he didn't publish. That's what this is.
So how does a city like Montreal handle that? Because at this point it's happened now. We can like talk about the past, and I think it's like probably timely as we do this, Just for Laughs is happening, we'll go see some shows this week, it's back. Is it easy to look at this place for what it once was rather than what it is or what it could be?
What it is, in between what it was and what it could be, is a pale substitute. What it is, and look, I've lived here my whole life. I spent my life promoting the city. I was on the board of Tours of Montreal for two terms, Trudeau and, no, I'm kidding, but that's a political joke. But for two terms, I was on the board of Tours of Montreal. So obviously, and I've never moved from this place despite having the opportunity. So obviously you can say that I do have a vested interest in it. But I remember what it was, and I know what it could be. So seeing what it is now, this claptrap of poor political decision-making, destroying the downtown core, construction after construction after construction. And I'm talking about the same street. I'm talking about different areas that are dug up, fixed, dug up again, fixed, dug up again. It's incredible to see this. The complacency, the irresponsibility, the incompetence of the administration. And look, I get the bike thing. I think that it's wonderful and it's important. But I also realize that you're by killing off commerce, what are you going to do? Wow, this is wonderful. All businesses are bankrupt. Downtown core has been decimated. But my God, I can ride my bike anywhere. So there's no coordination. There's no visionary. As much as people did not like Jean Drapeau, I mean, I like the guy. I have no real problem. And he had his ways. He's very authoritarian, but he was at least a guy with a vision. He was a guy with a vision, and tried big projects. What's our big project these days? It's an embarrassment when some of the smaller cities are able to take advantage of their uniqueness and exploit it. And Montreal, and let me tell you something. I know Yves Lalumière is the head of Tourism Montreal. What he does with the limited means he has. You know, it's incredible because the city does not give him a lot of cards to play.
Yeah.
The construction here, if I'm visiting here, and I know what it's like to drive downtown from where I live, and you want to just pull your hair out. I'm saying, okay, but I'm living here. If I'm visiting here, I'm saying, find me a reason to fight this versus I can go somewhere else and have it a whole lot easier and have an equal amount of things to do.
You talk about the vision thing. I've got a book called Unbuilt, and it's basically all the things and like big grand plans in the world that kind of never came to fruition. And Montreal has like the Mirabel Airport in there, which actually was built but never worked.
Yeah.
Or never really worked. I think there's like a really interesting thing of you look at this city from what in the 60s somebody had this idea of like grand expos, stadia, airports, transit systems. And some of it kind of did get built, but lots of it didn't. But now if you ask a lot of cities all across North America, what's your big vision? They haven't got one. It's sort of, I don't know if it's a unique to Montreal thing, but maybe in Montreal it sticks because it used to have it.
So, it had it big time. And Mirabel, I think, was just misjudged in terms of, well, let's build an airport away from the city when, you know, people want airports in the middle of the city to make it easier to get to, not to make things harder to get through, to get to. It's the same thing with your stadium, with your sports stadium. Like, I see what's happening in Atlanta. I read a story last week in the Wall Street Journal about Atlanta and its new ballpark and how it's not just a ballpark, but they built this baseball stadium surrounded by retail, by housing, by cultural centers, by, you know, clubs and stuff. And suddenly, and I know because I'm not a massive baseball fan, but I do like to go to a game or so in every, you know, when I'm in a city, let's say I'm in Pittsburgh or Boston, and you see what it's like to have this concentration. And it's not just concentration of building. It's thought out of, okay, let's get people there and keep them there. They're going to come from the ball game, stay to eat dinner. They're going to come to go see the Warhol Museum and cross the bridge and go to a ball game, you know, to see the Pirates play. Even though you may not be a baseball fan, you sit outdoors and... So it's thought out. And look, I'm going to give a microcosm of this. Last night in our hockey dressing room, we were talking about this tour that is taking place in somewhere in Scotland. It's a Scotch. You go there for 4 days and you go to four different distilleries and you taste Scotch and all of these distilleries that make Scotch. They have made, they're the centerpiece of their town, and you go there. And someone said, well, I went when I was in Amsterdam, I went to the Heineken Museum and I went there. It wasn't really much there, but that's where Heineken was made. And they made something out of it. And there was a big party room after. And there was you went to this beer museum, then you partied with Heineken beer. So I said, why isn't Molson doing that? Molson's beer has been around longer than Heineken. Why are we not doing this? This is a microcosm, let's say, Molson beer to do something that becomes a tourist attraction. But that's a microcosm of what a city could do and be. But I guess the problem is, and maybe it is this, that, you know, when Drapeau was around or Camille Wood or, you know, some of the more powerful Montreal mayors, they didn't give a shit. They just did stuff and they fought the good fight when people were against it. Now, no matter what you do, somebody is going to not just be against you, but against you to the point of trying to destroy what you're doing. And that's problematic. And people do not have enough power. And then again, I look what's happening in the United States when you see someone with enough power. It's just too bad that that type of power is not being used for the benefit of society. But that's a whole other story. So I guess it's easy. It's easy to say, hey, you know what? Let's just have a vision and carry it out. But you know that there's always somebody trying to stick the, you know, les bâtons dans les roues, as we say in French, and put the sticks in the spokes, put a spanner in the works, and, you know, throw things off.
How do you work through that though? Like, if I'm sure when you've done things in your past that when you did Just for Laughs, I'm sure there were people that were kind of like, no, I don't want this, or no, you're wrong, or it should work a different way. How do you get it back to the place where people can go, well, fuck this, I'm gonna, like, I've got a vision, I'm gonna give it a try, versus not have one at all?
Well, I guess there are certain things you have to have, which is, and I hate it because I sound like some authoritarian, I sound like Stalin right now, but you have to have absolute power. You really have to have absolute power to get this done. Because if you have to go ahead and think about minority governments, you're dead, you're finished, there's always going to be some, and then you're going to have to go ahead and compromise and make sort of some backroom deal to make sure what you do gets through, and some will always have something on you, or the compromise will only be 72% of what you really wanted it to be. You need absolute power. And going back to Drapeau and Hood and mayors like that, they kind of had that. Yeah. So I'm thinking just for laughs, luckily, I kind of had that. It was myself and my former partner who was the only person really above me who can put a stop to some of the lunacy I wanted to do. And he was involved doing other stuff, so he didn't really care about what, just let me do what I had to do. But I remember, it's a funny story because it's happening right now. I remember bringing YouTubers, because I thought YouTube was going to be the next big thing. And I was. But anyway, that's a whole other story. I brought YouTubers to the festival, and people, I'm not going to name names, but both of them are pretty influential. One of them is perhaps the most influential person in the comedy business today. They both said, we can't let them in, and we can't let them record, and they can't record here, and they can't record. I said, let them record wherever they want. Let them go backstage and record. Let them record from their seat. I don't care. Let them be. And I remember they wouldn't let them into the party, the closing party, even though they had a pass. Sorry, you're a YouTuber, you can't. And I went berserk. I said, they're allowed to get to the party. And what I found ironic is after banning these people, like 4 years later, 5 years later, once I moved on from Just for Laughs, some of these YouTubers were back. Lily Singh, I'll give you the name, hosting a gala. So suddenly they went from being these persona non grata to hosting the festival's biggest shows. But the fact was, despite everybody's opposition to it, I was able to get it through. Mm-hmm. And yes, they tried to hold them up at the party and stop them backstage. A phone call to me allowed it getting through. And again, I'm not saying the most powerful man in the world, but I was the most powerful man at that event. What can I tell you? For a time, I was. So this is how you get stuff done. But once you got a compromise, have let's have what's it called? When everyone sort of thinks together, it's a consensus. Yeah. Once you have to go for that, you're dead. You're history, because people, you cannot please everyone all the time. And sometimes, you know better than others. Other times you don't. But how are you going to find that out? Only by doing.
I think it's that thing, is the spirit to try. And there seems to be a thing that, and maybe I still look at this with Montreal fondly, is there's still a bit more grit and soul to give something a go here than you'll get in other places, albeit with a load of baggage of, this didn't work, or we're up against the province here, or we've sort of cuffed ourselves because of some sort of compromise somewhere else. There's still like a little bit of that. And I feel like if you let that go, you end up, if you like, you want to enable that spark rather than sort of extinguish its dying embers, basically.
Well, two things on that. You said the magic word, the province. One of the mitigating factors here, and one of the factors that it's holding Montreal down is the fact that the provincial government does not need Montreal. And I remember this distinctly. Years ago, we met with François Legault, a bunch of Anglo quote-unquote leaders met Legault. We were at Victoria Park in Westmount, upstairs, a whole bunch of us. And we asked him two things. One of the things about his governing style, he wasn't elected yet. He hadn't been elected yet. And this is the election where Philippe Couillard got in as a liberal. But he said, this is how I would govern. I would take polls, and whatever the polls said, I would react to it, because that's, you're asking the people what they think. I said, okay, depends who you're going to be asking here. And then he said, we were talking about Montreal, and he goes, you know what? Elections aren't won in Montreal. They're not won in 514, which is the area code here primarily. They're won in 450, and 450 is the area code of outside Montreal and taking all the way to 418, which is in Quebec City. That's where elections are won. So you have a government, a provincial government, at odds with its leading metropolis, with its leading tourism attractor, with its leading magnet, with its leading worldwide outreach, and it's at odds with it. It's like saying if New York State was fighting with Manhattan, Texas was fighting with Houston and Dallas to keep it down. And that's what you have, because the government does not say, well, let's see what's best for Montreal. They say, let's try to do what's best for everybody in Montreal. You're equal. No, we're not equal. We're bigger. We have more potential. Nothing wrong with the rest of the province. Nothing wrong whatsoever. But sometimes you just have to say, this is the fact. This is the reality. And this is the reality. And you have a government that won't face it. So that was one thing. But the second thing was, you said about, you need someone to really take this on. I'm speaking at Bishop's University at this thing called the Bishop's Forum, which is a gathering of Anglo-Quebecers, young Anglo-Quebecers who still want to stay here, you know, unlike so many who are just bolting from the place. And they're saying, how do we make this better? And my speech, I think it's called Tough Questions, Unhinged Answers, because, you know, I told them it's supposed to be, what's it called, Chatham House Rules, where it's, I said, you can say whatever you want, you can quote me however you want, as long as it's accurate. I don't care. You can say whatever you want, because I have nothing to lose now. You know what? I've been working 50 years. So go ahead, handcuff me, sew my lips together. But the city needs young activists. Of I'm not saying just Anglo, but activists, English, French, who are going to work together and say, we got to make this place better. And we got to go ahead and give it its place on the world stage. And believe me, I speak French, you know, pretty well, and I was in the milieu for years. And I understand its power, and it has a culture and a feeling and a spirit all to itself. And that's phenomenal. But how do you take that and extrapolate that and use it as a benefit to go ahead and position yourself in the world without seemingly, you know, closing the doors on students coming from out of town, or the use of a language by buskers in Quebec City? Because they say, well, you can't sing in English. No, but it's almost ridiculous when people go berserk. Well, I was on the hold, and the music on hold was in English. Or I go to a hockey game, and you know, the music in between,
the play, where is
more in English than in French. How are you going to win when you have small-mindedness like that? Impossible.
But I think it's like it's the weird thing of it seems like it has to be my way or no way, rather than being the province and the city. Like if you're going to win provincial elections without Montreal's still going to pay for you. So it always feels the weird thing to sort of suffocate the city that is the thing that funds your economy on a provincial level, when the solution might be, well, I'm going to do everything I want to go win votes in the provinces. At the same time, as you lot do what you want to do. Like, you lot can have your power in the city, I can have my power in the province, and then everybody should be sort of broadly happy. I think that's the thing where it all sort of, I don't get the, maybe this is naivety on my part, but it's almost as that I need to suffocate you to make me thrive, when actually both of you can thrive by doing your own things.
Oh my God, that is, I think, the scourge of most relationships, be they personal, political, business. You know, I have to suffocate you so I can thrive, versus seeing, you know, that's why we you know, so many of us just don't get along. But you know, one of the things I've realized in politics, and I'm not, believe me, no expert, but I've met a number of politicians, some pretty high-ranking politicians, world leaders, and some local civic counselors and all. By and large, they're pretty decent people. I'm not saying they're horrible people, because they're not. But a job of a politician is what? Oh, yes, the job description says you are there to serve the people. My ass. You are there to get reelected. Because once you're elected, you don't want to be unelected. You don't want to be, if you're sitting in government and you are part of the sitting ruling party, you don't want to be it goes down the list. You don't want, if you're a minister, you don't want to be a backbencher. If you're a backbencher in a winning team, you don't want to be, you know, an opposition critic for the losing side. So no matter what, it's all about getting reelected. So these things that are done are not done for the betterment of the populace. They're done for the betterment of, okay, if we do this, this means more votes. And I learned that lesson. It's so funny. I learned that lesson so many years ago when I was at Just for Laughs. This woman named Madeleine Carreau, who was running the French side while I was running the English side. And she came from the PQ. She was like some minister's, you know, basically chef de cabinet, like the cabinet chief. I don't know what the English terminology is. And she came to run the French side. And then she went out to run the MSO, and really big businesswoman, understood her stuff, and she was, you know, no nonsense. I remember asking her, I said, I just don't get it. The English side, you know, we bring in mega stars. This is like late 1980s, early 90s. We bring in mega TV stars, mega film stars that everybody in the province wants to see. The Quebec ministers, even the PQ ministers, would want to go to the English galas because they would see stars they would never see ever. The other stars, the French stars, they would see at the dépanneur, the dry cleaner. Again, nothing wrong with that, but these were people integrated into everyday life. But the people who are coming from Hollywood or New York or London or wherever were not. And I said, this is what we're doing. We're bringing HBO live. We're bringing live television to. I don't understand why the French side gets all the money. And she said, I'll tell you why. Because Americans do not vote here. And I said, okay, there's your answer.
So if I gave you absolute power, let's say there's the benevolent dictator of Montreal and Quebec and Andy Norman.
Oh, you have to put benevolent there, Jesus.
I don't expect it to be like the Stalin.
Have to put that qualifier, don't you? Go ahead.
We can remove it. You can be an evil bastard if you want to be.
Go ahead. So?
But if everyone went, you know what, fuck this. This whole argument is ridiculous. Like, let's pack off Legault. There's a Montreal election. Let's just not bother having it. And let's put Andy in charge. What would you do differently to make Montreal amazing?
Well, first of all, I would sit down with a whole bunch of young people and say, please tell me what's happening in the future. Tell me where life is going. Oh, AI? Okay, great. Everyone's doing AI now. But what's our take on AI? Where do we fit in? Like, we can't just say AI. It's like saying oxygen. It's like saying we want to be big in the internet. Yeah, but where in the internet? Do you want to do the servers? Do you want to do the creation of this? What do you want to do? So AI is just one piece of the puzzle, and it's perhaps an easy cliche piece. But I'd sit down with people and say, what is a city? What should it be? What do you want to do? What are the important parts? Well, there's commerce. There's culture. There's freedom of expression. There are things like that. There are things, what do you do in the winter to attract people? What do you do in the winter to make life easier for people to get around in terms of transportation? So all these things have to be thought out. But you're saying if you want to make, I guess the goal would be, if you bring all these people together, say, okay, don't give me a committee. Don't give me, we're having this focus group and all that. Give me suggestions. Give me ideas. Give me passion. Give me people who are going to do it and say, what is a perfect city look like? And now that we have know what a perfect city looks like, how do we take the best parts of that and bring it into a city that has its imperfections, meaning weather, meaning politics, meaning the linguistic divide, meaning all these things. So that's what I would do. I would go ahead and say, let's say what is a perfect city and why, and how much of this can we accomplish given what we have. And then again, you choose your battles to say we cannot be all things to all people, but let's be great at these three things. And these three things will be enough to attract industry and population and media attention and tourists. And the money, and the more money we have, the more we can do. Because it's always the excuse. And it's in everything, even some of the projects I'm working on right now, it's not the lack of ideas. It's the lack of funding. And but then again, because people aren't going to fund shitty ideas, and they aren't going to fund things they don't necessarily believe in. So how do you bring all that together? So it's like writing anything. You have to bring your dreamers, your realists, your culture people, your commerce people, and you have to say, we're all doing this for the greater good, not like, okay, how much money can I make by screwing this guy? Or what project could I do by ripping off that guy?
It's that sort of, but like going and giving it a go is what ultimately then proves this could or couldn't work. And I think there's so much of the money is sucked up into how do we justify making the decision? And you get to the point where you spent more money than you might spend justifying the decision and doing the smallest possible thing you could have done to go see what might work. And I think that's a switch that cities and companies struggle with.
It's a conversation I had an hour ago where we're talking about somebody trying to take a risk in a company. And it's something that you and I lived with the Atlantic Lottery Corporation, where people are going to say, if I take a risk, here's my win. My win is a little bump in salary, maybe a little bonus, and a nice plaque press release. If I lose, I lose my cushy job, that paid this. I had this expense account. I had this house over on top of the hill with this great view, and I'm going to lose all that. So if I don't do something, I'm better off than doing something because the risk is less. And that's the thing. So what will people do? Let's spend the money to say, hey, I'm spending this money. And sometimes I'm even guilty of this. Think about a couple of things I did. Let's spend the money to go ahead and justify the decision that's going to be made, because perhaps people do not have enough faith in me to make that decision. So that's what people will do. So yeah, the money gets sucked up into the justification. By the time justification comes into place, perhaps it's too late. So
I feel like you need this sort of like failure fund. So it's like if you go and take this bad decision, or if you go and take this decision, here's your if it's really so awful that we want to get rid of you, here's your parachute out of here so you can land on your feet. But also, if it goes well, here's what you could have won. Here's your reward package of when it goes well. Rather than it being like, I need to sandbag the expectations all the time so that when I do well, I almost want to not look like I've done so well, because then how am I going to repeat my feat?
Yeah, I've come across a lot of that, but I just think that hopefully the new generation will bring together entrepreneurs and social entrepreneurs who are not necessarily worried about that. And also find ways, again, this sounds so utopian, find ways to reward the general populace. Just, you know, not just to reward the leaders, but how do you reward the general populace? It's the same thing, like, I guess you're looking at a public company. The guy, the woman, they who run a public company are well compensated, but so are the public company as well. So are the investors, the employees and the shareholders. How do you make your citizen a shareholder and make him, her, they rewarded by something that the city does, and they're not going to complain about it?
I think that nobody thinks of like the citizen in that way. It's almost like you'll be happy with what you got, and if you're not happy, we'll jack up your taxes anyway because we made a mistake, and you're going to pay for the mistake. But there's a lot of, I feel like you don't necessarily get the. I remember growing up in the UK, and you would see in shit bits of the UK, it would be like road project funded by the European Union in tiny, tiny letters. And ultimately, it was those bits of the UK that voted for Brexit because they didn't really understand what they got back from the European Union. And I think there's almost like a thing for like people who live in a city, they don't necessarily know what they pay for and what they get in return for it. And if you actually celebrate those things more, then the people go, hang on a minute, I don't know. Some cities do free museum admission. Some cities talk a bit more about how they've done invested in schools. Some they might be like sports facilities. I don't know. But like, I don't feel like nobody really wants to talk about it because they're worried about there was a sinkhole in the tennis court and we might get told off for it. So we'll just not tell anybody that it exists.
I've seen a lot of those signs, your tax dollars at work and all that. But I think there has to be a better way to do that. Like, I was just thinking, there's this radio station I listened to. It's out of Los Angeles. It's a public radio station. It just had to have this... membership drive yesterday because they got all the money that was promised was rescinded by the Trump government. So this little radio station out of this college in Northridge, California, lost $125,000. They went on the air yesterday with this member, this drive, this fundraising drive to try and get some of it, if not all of it back, or all of it, if not some of it back. Anyway, and I was thinking, because I converse with them from time to time, like, how do they make this money up now? They can't continue to just reach out to the listeners and say, this, please give, please give, please give. And I thought it would be, they're a non-commercial station, but I thought, sometimes you got to do what you got to do. And maybe what they can do is have, it's almost like a building, or like when you go to a synagogue or a church where you have, the rooms or the pews donated by, there's a plaque. So here's a show, and it's it's the Matt Pinfield, Ian Montgomery presents the Matt Pinfield Show, and Ian Montgomery is the sponsor of the week. He's just a guy, but he just put in enough money to do that. So you basically put a plaque on every radio show. But the same thing here, to your point, is show people doing good, and never mind just show people good. Find ways for people to interact with the people doing good.
I think so. You see that like your tax dollars at work, but it always seems to be a road sign telling you how expensive it is to build a new road.
Yeah,
and it's like, fuck me, that's an expensive road. Rather than it being like, what's the benefit that I get? And it never really talks about, like, you don't see it on like the little things that you just don't, that you sort of take for granted. I guess that's where I'm going.
Yeah. Well, it needs work. I think most cities need work, but some of them really seem to have their act together and know who they are, where they stand, their positive points, their pain points, maximize the former, minimize the latter, and make themselves known. I think of Santa Fe, New Mexico. I'm thinking of Austin, Texas. These don't have to be metropolis.
Yeah.
These could just be some really great little towns that have, and you don't need a lot. There are certain times where you say, we got this. And because we have this and that, we're enough for you to visit. I think of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland. I think of, you know, the Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh. I went to Pittsburgh specifically for the Warhol Museum, and I was amazed at the things I found in that city. Incredible.
Pittsburgh's one of the most underrated cities anywhere.
Incredible. Just amazing. But I went there for one thing. You know, and I think it's really important in this day and age. It was not important in the other days and ages. But now you have to have a hook. What is your, I know it sounds like marketing 101, but what is your US, you know, your USP? What is your unique selling proposition? When you say, what is the top of mind awareness when you say Montreal? What is it? And, you know, is that what you want it to be? If not, how are you going to change it? What is New York? New York, a city that doesn't sleep, Broadway, sport, business, food. Okay, I got it. There's a reason to, you know, Statue of Liberty, Empire State Building, reason to visit. You know, what's Boston? Fenway Park, and it's, you know, this and that, and it's Harvard. Well, you know, that can be debated nowadays. But it's, you know, but it's, okay, it's a city of universities. Montreal was a city of festivals. That's the way it was marketed for a number of years. And it was a phenomenal marketing campaign because it was, you knew you were coming here, and at you know, most points in time, there was going to be a big event that you can go to. Well, that's a beautiful way to market a city. I didn't really even understand it when I was running Just for Laughs in the early days. But man, when we started to reap the benefits of it, I said, okay, that's what they're thinking about us as. That's not bad. Versus Montreal.
I've never seen Montreal sold that way in the time that I've been coming here, but I can see how it would have worked.
Not anymore.
Yeah.
When I was there, it was the Jazz. It was Just for Laughs. It was, and there were, that's why there were so many festivals that still around. Fantasia, Nuit d'Afrique, because it was in the age of burgeoning festivals and support and finance festivals. But at least it gave people to say, oh, that pretty much all, it's the city of festivals versus it's the city of poor roads and construction and bike paths in the way of everything and nowhere to shop and language problems and protests and blocking streets, which is really what it's become, unfortunately.
I think there's an interesting thing of I'm very pro bike lane, as was evidenced when I turned up completely sopping wet when we had beers last week. But like, I think that's like a positive, but it becomes one of those things of you can overdo it and you can put too many in, or you can put some in and not take some out, and you can do them in the wrong place and it can get messy. And I think that's where we're at. But I know lots of people who come here because they really like that about the city. It's probably the best city to cycle in North America. It's also the best city to cycle out of in North America, I'd argue too. But a lot of people, when I first started coming to Montreal, Anthony Bourdain was the one that was probably doing a better job of selling Montreal than the Montrealers were.
Sure.
And he's been gone from this earth for quite a while now. It's like, it shows that you need the things that step into the shoes that keep promoting a city. And I think the people in the city and the people in the positions to promote the city, I don't know, I feel like they've just got a bit complacent.
But that's two things. Let's talk about Montreal, talking about cities. A huge part of Montreal is winter. Love it or hate it, it's winter. So let's go back to two things. I remember I once did this on, I used to do this stuff for Newswatch on CBC Radio, CBC TV. And I did these like sardonic, sarcastic reports at the end of newscast on Fridays. And I talked about ways to sell Montreal. And I said, you know, especially in the winter, how to sell the winter. And I said, well, you know, what you do is you sell Montreal winter to people in, you know, the Arctic Circle, Antarctic, and some of the coldest countries. Don't say, oh my God, it's warm here. You know, what? It's only minus 10? Wow, it's incredible. You know, obviously, I'm being facetious there. But let's go back to the bike paths for a second. I agree. On a day like today, I'm looking out my window and it's sunny and gorgeous and the temperature's not too hot. What a phenomenal day to ride a bike in and around the city. I know this because I went on a cruise recently, my girlfriend, and a couple of cities where we just said, yeah, let's just take a bike. It's phenomenal. But the weather works for it. So here, from let's say May till September, end of September, mid-September, the weather is ideal for it, okay? But after that, it's not. So what happens, the reality is, hey, guess what? It's not really the time anymore for this, so let's get rid of the bike paths and let me have more room for cars and parking and snow removal and all that stuff. Yet, what happens is the, you know, in my view, maybe I'm wrong, the administration says, no, we're going to keep bike paths. For those people who ride bikes in winter, which is a major minority of diehards. And so you're sitting there, you're sitting at a light and you're waiting to turn and you can't, and the bike light lane is like flashing. There's no bikes. Why? Because it's snowing or because it's minus 40.
There aren't There are an incredible number of people who will ride a bike. I'm genuinely impressed by the number of people who do ride a bike in the snow here. I'm too soft for it to do it very often.
I get it. I know, but still, it's a diehard. And when you say, let's put that up against the needs of the general populace, the general populace, in my mind, wins. But the same, I say the same thing in the summer. You know what? The general populace, people who could and should be riding a bike, should win. But that doesn't mean you win 12 months of the year. It means you win when the time is right. Anyway, don't get me started.
No. This is an argument I'm very happy to sort of disagree with you agreeably. I think there's probably 2 or 3 months where you really don't want to ride a bike.
Okay, so those 2 or 3 months.
Yeah.
Get rid of it.
But and I think what frustrates me is there's often days in those 2 or 3 months where you can, but like we design the bike infrastructure to be. I would look at it and go, what bits of bike infrastructure would you change for a city where you might not necessarily bike every day? And how would you make that safe around cars rather than copying what's deemed best practice from Amsterdam?
I wouldn't use that.
So like,
I pull the things out. So those indicators, you pull them out. And
I think it's like no one's ever done this sort of thing to go like, how do I make this work in different ways? Because I would very happily get rid of my car in this city, but the transit doesn't exist to a strong enough extent, and the car sharing isn't good enough, even though it's okay. And I think that's the thing, like there's so much creative talent in Montreal that you should be able to apply that to those problems.
I agree.
But we're too scared to.
I agree. You're looking at that, but it's the same argument saying, you know what? By and large, it's sunny in the summer, so I'm going to dress for sun. But today it's pouring rain, but you know, I'm going to dress for the sun because by and large, it's sunny in the summer. So the same thing with the bike paths. So yeah, there are certain two, three days in the winter where you can ride a bike. That's hallelujah. But most of them, you can't. So the same thing, look, if that's the case, if it rains, I'm just going to walk out and get wet and pretend it's not rain.
I appreciate we've managed to have that debate without shouting at each other, because too often people are just screaming at one another and they're not coming to any sort of sensible conclusion.
Conclusion is, you know, we may have two different ideas what a sensible conclusion is. But a sensible conclusion to me is it has its place. But when is its place? When is it not its place? It's like anything else. You know, I don't know. There are certain times, certain things are 24/7. Other things aren't 24/7. What is 24/7? Decide what it is. Okay, that's 24/7. And what is 26 or 18/5 or 12/4?
I think a good example of where Montreal sort of does this well is like when they close Montreal and various other streets like Ontario and whatnot during the summer.
Right.
And there's no cars on it.
Okay, so why not all year round? So there's a perfect example. Okay, right. So, well, you know, if it works in June, why will it not work in February? Because it's goddamn cold and because it snows. But there's rationale.
I think Montreal would work all year round. I don't think Ontario would work all year round. But I think like the way, if you were to design it even where you close it for 6, 7, 8 months to cars and have it more open to people walking, why are we not doing more to change what the physical layout of the street is versus making it just look like a road that's got some chalk on it? I think that's the thing that with a bike, like if I had a bike lane that's going to be a bike lane for, let's call it 9 months of the year, what does that bike lane look like for the other three? And how do you make it look amazing for 9 months without it feeling temporary? And how do you make it so that the odd lunatic who does want to ride a bike in February doesn't feel scared of somebody driving their car down the street? And I think that's the sort of thing of nobody wants to have the conversation of the nuance. And without that, we end up like with the silly argument.
I agree. And I also like, look, I did Montreal. I walked down it last Friday and I was disappointed because it was okay. So they close off the street and they put a couple of wooden blocks in the middle of it. Okay. Is that really going to make it?
It's underwhelming.
Yeah, it is underwhelming. And you look at places, again, you can't compare, but I don't know if you've ever been to the Grove in Los Angeles, or near CBS Studios, or the Farmer's Market near CBS Studios. Oh my God. The Grove is this sort of like small, you know, it's an outdoor mall, but it's more like a small city, and it's designed, you know, by walking around, it's in circles, and there's roundabouts. It's really a spectacular place to be, to spend time. You know, it's like that Atlanta thing I talked about before. You go there for X, but you stay for Y and Z. But same thing with the farmer's market in LA. It's a destination, but it's built with the mind of how do you keep people there in a very, very efficient manner. And I can't really give you many great examples of that in this city right now.
I think the Montreal thing was very cool when they started doing it, but now it feels like a it feels like a zombie project.
Yes, I saw that last week. I was embarrassed. I wanted to leave. I said, let's get somebody to eat, let's get out of here, versus let's hang out.
Other block, like, I think Dan in Hochelaga, they do a better job of putting more street furniture out for places to sit and people to play and eat food and drink and whatnot. But I think the Montreal one just feels tired now. Andy, I want to talk about PAX briefly because...
Okay.
Your latest career act is very noble, worthy, and actually fucking interesting. So lots of people get to this point where they want to do something that's sort of giving back and doing good for the world, and it becomes a bit boring. Whereas what you're doing is really fucking interesting. So
that's what we're trying. Sure. We're trying to do this. I mean, if people want to know more, it's thepowertoact.org is the way to find PACT. But what PACT is, it's really Stephen Bromfman. I'm running this project for him, with him. And it's his intent. We've had this conversation. He's a philanthropist and he's a strong do-gooder, particularly in the world of climate. He was on the climate train 30 years ago when people thought he was like some tree-hugging hippie. And look at where climate is now. He saw the need for climate, the fight of climate change 30 years ago. And now the thing is about we're working for radical goodness, anti-hate. And it's more radical goodness than anti-hate because anti-hate is a double negative and you know where the double negatives go. Basically, what we want to do is do good, but in a very subversive way. We see the bad, the do-gooders, the sweet, let's make love beautiful, peace, and all that. Not these people are poor intentioned; they're well-intentioned, but it's all done with consensus. Let's make sure everybody's happy, and let's not offend, and we will, our iconography are like butterflies and unicorns and rainbows and teddy bears, and our color scheme is pastel, and the bad guys are like knives and guns and skulls and spiders and red and flames and Satan. So if you look just on a pure aesthetic level, what would you rather have a poster of in your home? What t-shirt would you rather wear? You're going to want to wear the cool one. The bad guys do bad real well, and the good guys do good poorly. So what we really wanted to do with PACT is become, for lack of a better term, the bad guys of doing good. It's not about consensus, it's about having guts, it's about doing things differently, it's about taking a page from the bad guy's playbook to do good, not running through things through legal, it's taking risks, but doing things in a way that's going to shake people up, point the finger at hypocrisy, demean hate, diffuse hate, make people laugh at it, take away its power, and do things in a very, very subversive, proactive, youth-oriented social media manner. So that's really what PACT's all about.
But I really like you've done this as like a Jewish guy in Montreal without doing the usual stereotypical anti-hate, anti-Semitic, anti-Islamic kind of shtick.
Yeah,
like, well, I really like appreciate that your take on that is then turning it into, and the first thing that you've kind of gone and done with it, being like the impossible pair.
Yeah,
you've done it in a fun, positive way that can be desirable versus like, I should probably give some money to those guys.
Well, again, this comes from Stephen, because we had many conversations about what it is we're about, and people immediately assume, well, you're Jewish, it has to be about anti-Semitism. And it's not that things cannot be about anti-Semitism, because it is about, there's definite hate there, but there's hate all over. And our job, what we really see, is to not build protectionism or say, let's do more security. It's but getting it at its root and say, how do we change the way people think? What do we do to make people think differently? So to his credit, Stephen has been pushed in many ways to say, Stephen, this should be more about anti-Semitism, and I will fund your project if you make this about anti-Semitism. And he goes, no, it's not. As a Jew, what he believes, and what we all believe in PACT, is if you really want to help the Jews, you have to help everybody. If you really want to help any one group, you have to help everybody, because of the fact you cannot say, and which is what we see, with many groups saying, we're all about love, but fuck everybody else. And that's what you're seeing. And I can give you very, very specific examples of that. And to Stephen's credit, he says that is not who we are. We're about doing things for everybody. So the impossible parent you talked about is a very, very simple yet effective promotion. We did this, we launched it at C2. We actually did it live. If people want to know more about this, go to our websites. There's a Dike. It's a combination of a Dike, of Nike and Adidas. So it's A-D-I-K-E, Adidas and Nike, adike.store, S-T-O-R-E, or Nididas, N-I, you know, D-I-D-A-S.store. But adike.store is a real easy one to remember.
I'll put a link in the thing.
Okay, yeah. And you'll see that. You'll see what it is. It's called the Impossible Pair, and the basic notion is, look, we did this completely without the authorization of Nike and Adidas, but we said, we'll put two different shoes in one box, and we said if the stripes and the swoosh can cuddle and lie together in the same box, why can't we on the same planet? And we sold the Impossible Pair. We raised money for a group called Ensemble pour la Respect de Diversité, Together for the Respect of Diversity. All the money went to them. And basically, it's a black shoe and a white shoe, and they're worn together. So we always say, people, I wear them every day. And people come to me and say, why are you wearing two different shoes? I say, well, they're different, but so what? It shows that you can be different and live together. On the same hue, in the same body, I have two different shoes, yet I'm walking properly and they go well together despite the fact that they're different. So again, we say that if they can live in the same box, why can't we on the same planet? If we can live in the same person, why can't we? And that's a symbol that gets out there, and suddenly it's become this fashion icon. We're bringing it to New York Fashion Week. Don't ask some of the stuff we're doing there with this, but it's all under the guise of showing that you can be different and live together. That's the underlying message. So is it the most subversive thing in the world? No. Is it the most common thing in the world? Also no, because by and large, most groups will look at this and say, we can't do it because legal won't allow it, or we may get in trouble, we may get sued. And here there's Stephen Bronfman, who's the scion of one of the most, you know, the dynasty families of North America. He's third generation running this massive dynasty. And he says, I don't give a damn. I'm not afraid of anything. I believe in this, and I'm going to go ahead and do it. And if anybody has something to lose, it's someone like that. And Stephen has all the guts in the world to pull this off. So, yeah, there, I you know, again, a lot of credit to the guy, you know, who I'm working with to get this done, but because he's not afraid. So we talk about subversive. Most people would never do that, say, because they're worried about what the man would say. Well, Stephen doesn't care. Let's just do it and let's make our point. And we have a lot of other projects that we're working on. Ian, you're going to be heartbroken with this. We are actually having our own podcast, which is being hosted by a guy named Josh Molina, co-host by Josh Molina. Josh was in the West Wing. But basically, it's a history of political, positive, entertaining political activism for good. And it's a history of all these projects, one a week that we're going to be focusing on. And the message is this: all this stuff is done by ordinary people. It was not done by a corporation. It was not done by a government. It was done by ordinary people who gave a damn and wanted to make a difference. And there's some brilliant things there. But the underlying message at the end of each episode is, okay, so what are you doing? Which means, okay, so are you sitting on your ass doing nothing and saying, oh, I wish I could. What are you doing? Get off your ass and do something. Or what are you doing? Meaning, wow, you're doing something great we don't know about. Let us know. So that's the podcast. And there's so many other things as well that we're doing with PACT.
I'm a big fan of that podcast idea, because the reason I started doing this is because someone said, stop moaning and do something. So this was my little way of doing something. So for cities. And I still think there's an impossible... We'll talk more about Impossible Pair when we go for beers and hang out again. But I still think there's an impossible thing, pair thing in there for what's the impossible pair of a city that's amazing for cycling, but also a city where we don't act like dicks to people who drive cars. So there's something in that to bring the cities thing back to sort of the positive PACT messaging to that. I don't know the answer to it, but I think there's something good to that.
Well, I think that it really works. We've had that discussion, and perhaps a city, it's too wide. The discussion I had today with somebody from a major shoe brand, athletic shoe brand, I won't say which, because you know, he said a lot of things that perhaps get him in trouble. He says that, you know what, we deal with the sports teams. So one of we know the owner of the Maple Leafs, we know the owner of the Canadians. Maybe we should do an impossible pair of Leafs Canadians sweater collab, and not split down the middle, that, you know, it's so cliche, but do a Maple Leaf sweater in red, white, and blue, the Canadians colors, and do a Canadian sweater in the blue and white of the Leafs.
Yeah. So there's an old, I think it's an old Habs jersey that's got a Leafs logo on it.
Yeah, it was a CAC, and it was that was the worst. That's
quite
the
ugly.
Worst logo I've ever seen. Yes, but it was different. It certainly was. That's horrible. I still get nightmares.
Andy, I end these conversations on if I gave you a magic wand. I know I talked to you earlier about being a benevolent dictator, but if I gave you a magic wand, what's one thing you would do to make Montreal a better city?
Construction. I would make the roads smooth as glass and find a way to melt the snow in the winter. I would just get rid of all construction on our roads and make it an easy city to traverse, whether it's by bike or car or foot or whatever, unicycle or
pogo stick,
whatever. If you can get around, it makes life a whole. Once you open up, it's like a human being. If the circulation is good within your vein, the blood flow is good, everything else is going to work. So if you go ahead and you make the blood flow of a city, which is the circulation, work well, then people are going to be able to go out easier, go out to eat, shop. It's easier to get out. And it may take, even if you're still ordering from Amazon, if it's easier to get up and around, the trucks will find it easier to get to your place. So that's the thing I would do with magic wand.
That is an analogy that you've just made that is going to make you famous amongst the transportation planner community. It's probably not where you want to be famous, but I think you'll take it nonetheless.
I'll take it nonetheless, as long as they provide me with a helicopter.
Do you enjoy that? See, there is somebody who is a dear friend of mine who likes to drive his car downtown. And me, as somebody who likes to go meet him on a bicycle, even if it means when I ride my bicycle to go meet Andy, I end up completely soaking wet and looking like a giant rat through the course of the meeting. But we can have agreeable disagreements. Isn't that nice? Anyway, thank you once again for listening all the way through to the end of this episode. Usual rules apply. Like, share, comment. Do the things that, gives it a bit more reach. I'm just not just talking into the void. But yeah, once again, we will see you very, very soon for a new episode of the Challenger Cities podcast. Thank you very much, and goodbye.